You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Jared Hill, in for Steve Chiatakis. Today, let's go to my neighborhood in the city of Inglewood. It's a place that's changing. So far, the changes are happening kind of quietly and subtly, like a seed that's planted in the ground and spreads its roots before popping out. It's gentrifying. It starts with property values going up. That leads to a lot of other changes in the neighborhood. But you can't quite see it here on Market Street yet. It's a commercial strip with wide sidewalks and lots of small businesses. So you see clothing stores, a beauty supply shop, a watch repair place, and also empty storefronts.
I think it's good that the city is being renewed, and I'm excited about businesses coming back to the city.
Monique Washington is standing outside a coffee shop.
But it's changing very rapidly. You're outpricing a lot of people. Where do they go?
That's what everybody's wondering. Where are people going to go? Two-thirds of the people in Inglewood rent. I rent. Are we going to be priced out? Because money's coming in. There's a billion-dollar NFL stadium under construction right now, to name just one of the many big developments planned for the city. Also, Inglewood is just east of Silicon Beach, where there are tens of thousands of tech jobs. All those workers are looking for a decent commute. So, in the past few years, real estate investors have bought up and are building up apartment buildings, and in many cases, raising rents. I've been seeing this happen. KCRW's Anna Scott has been out in the city with her microphone reporting on it. So she's here now to discuss. Hey, Anna.
Hey.
All right. I'll tell you what's been on my mind. Inglewood is home to one of LA County's few largely Black communities, but Black homeownership is at an all-time low in the United States. That creates some anxiety. There are a lot of Black renters who are very vulnerable. The city's been trying to address this, and you recently spoke to Mayor James Butts about it. What did he have to say?
Yeah, so I spoke recently to the mayor of Inglewood, James Butts, and he says that he is trying to strike this balance between protecting longtime residents who are vulnerable, who are there, but also welcoming in all of this new investment. One of the things that he points to is the city's first ever rent control ordinance, which was passed back in June. So that limits rent increases in most cases to 5% a year. This is interesting because the last time I spoke to James Butts, 2 years ago, he was completely against rent control and said it would economically strangle the city. So I wanted to ask Butts what changed. And he said one thing is that with increasing rents, prices going up, it all accelerated much faster than he thought it would.
You know, we found some isolated instances where rents were being raised 50 to 75%. That wasn't the rule. But as soon as you have one or two dramatic instances, that becomes the narrative. And so we moved aggressively to deal with it.
At the same time, Butts has been a big champion of all the new investment coming into Inglewood, of the NFL stadium, of all the other big projects that are planned. And he argues that on the whole, all this new investment is good for the city and that it's the result of a lot of work he's been doing.
We've come a long ways, not just in our ability to attract sports and entertainment, but in riding our fiscal house and providing greater service and resources. We're in our eighth consecutive year of the lowest crime rate in the history of the city. We've had one murder this year in Inglewood through 8 months. That is unheard of in the history of the city. You add in the drop in the unemployment rate, which is drastic and dramatic, from 17.5% to 4.7, one of the lowest unemployment rates for a majority minority city in the country. And we haven't sold one football ticket, one basketball ticket.
So I think he's right in some elements. Like, there are some good things happening in the city, and I don't want to argue that. But I will say, to that last point about the professional sports, this makes me think of Oakland and Brooklyn. They both have like a close proximity to tech or a major cosmopolitan city. They're both largely Black cities where a stadium comes in Brooklyn, or the major team starts doing really well in Oakland with the Warriors. And then the city gets less and less Black and more expensive.
Yes, it's a phenomenon that definitely we've seen before, and it's hard to come up with an example. And I did ask Butts about this. Is there another community that you can point to around the country that has pulled off the balance that he's talking about trying to accomplish, which is reaping all of the benefits of this new investment without significant displacement of the existing community?
There is no city in the country that has transitioned from a brand of unemployment, poverty, high crime, to where Inglewood has transitioned in just 4 years. So there is no template.
Now, make no mistake, people are already being pushed out of the city. Some are struggling with big rent increases that happened before the rent control ordinance passed. Some have already moved out. And just in the last couple of weeks, I spoke to a manager at one of the missions down on Skid Row, the Los Angeles mission, who told me that he's seen what he called a mini wave of at least a dozen newly homeless people show up there who last had housing in Inglewood, but were pushed out by large rent increases, including two senior citizens in August.
So, you know, this is having a negative impact for folks like you're talking about. And then it's also having a positive impact for homeowners. I have a good friend who owns a condo in Inglewood. That condo more than doubled in value in, you know, 2 or 3 years, according to Zillow. That's extraordinary growth for homeowners. And we know that 1/3 of the people in Inglewood do own homes. And for the investors that are coming in and buying up or building a property. So it's good for those people anyway.
Yeah. And I did speak to some longtime homeowners in Inglewood who are definitely happy about the changes and seeing the benefits of it, like Lori Penix.
I am a realtor. I predominantly work in the LA area, Inglewood area, and I also live in the Inglewood area as well. I own a house, yeah.
So she's benefiting in many ways. She's a realtor, so business-wise she is. She's also a landlord and a homeowner in Inglewood. She's very happy about the changes. She was not in favor of the rent control ordinance back in June, but she also does have some mixed feelings about the community changing.
I think the challenge that some people have, or the experience that some people have, is that newer voices and newer people coming to the community and feeling like they're the ones that's going to make the change. And that's very uncomfortable for people who feel like, I've been here working for these changes for years.
So one of the things I talked to you about was some of the positive changes that I can see that are happening that do speak to why haven't we been able to get these kinds of things in the past. I know there's a Starbucks location near me where I remember complaining to the manager, like, why is the internet so slow? And she's like, the internet in the city is slow. It's not like a Starbucks thing. It's a city thing. Hmm. I was out of town for a few weeks and I came back and La Brea had been completely repaved. And I was like, oh, now we get like a nicer street, you know, and it kind of makes you feel like, why couldn't we have these things before?
Sure. And of course, I have not reported out the reasons for the slow internet or the repaving of the street, so can't speak specifically to why it is that these things are happening now. But what you're saying is definitely something that I've heard from a lot of people, which is the feeling that so-called neighborhood improvements come in not for the existing community, but in many cases at their expense.
Mm-hmm. There's another thing about communities changing color. It just feels different. As a minority, I'm a black man. I know we're on the radio, so people can't see. They don't know what I look like. But I'm a black man, and there's something about being a minority and being living out in the world that is largely white, especially Los Angeles, and having a code switch and be able to be comfortable in spaces where people don't look like you or understand you, and being able to go home to a place that does look like you and does kind of feel like you and feel familiar at the very least. And so, like, seeing your neighborhood change and evolve into something else, like, there's some kind of uncomfortability about that. And I can relate to the feeling of, like, wanting to see nicer things, but also wanting to feel comfortable where you live.
Yeah, a lot of people talked about that same feeling, including Lori.
I have a black son. And for me, I like the idea that my son gets a real experience of what the black community is outside of the things that you see on the news. My son is a soccer player and my husband is a big referee, and it's a really big thing for our family. But I go to the soccer field and I see lots of black and brown faces, and I feel a great sense of pride because those aren't things that are reflected in the media. But that's real life. And so I love that my son gets to see this. And my son, who goes to school in Palos Verdes, an independent school that is very expensive, he gets to see that side as well. And he gets to feel whole.
There's so much to talk about. I feel like we could go on and on and on about this. But I'm very curious to see the ways that Inglewood will continue to change. And I'm also really, like, hopeful about the ways that I hope it can stay the same. So I really appreciate your reporting on this. Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
And now, a separate story with a little bit of overlapping history to what you just heard. One critical but often overlooked part of the housing market is money lending. Financing, the types of loans available, how hard they are to get, who gets them, has a huge impact on the entire housing landscape. Decades ago, in the 1940s, it was nearly impossible for African Americans in Los Angeles to get bank loans. Racist mortgage lending restrictions, or redlining, kept Black people from buying homes in many neighborhoods, including Inglewood, which at the time was overwhelmingly white. So, in 1946, a group of well-known Black civic leaders started their own bank, the Broadway Federal Savings and Loan Association. Over time, that institution morphed into Broadway Federal Bank, which stands today as the only Black-owned bank in the entire Western United States. It's headquartered inside an office building in Mid-Wilshire. There, KCRW's Anna Scott recently spoke to the head of the Broadway Federal Bank, and she picks up the story from here.
Back when Broadway Federal was founded, the entire geography of Los Angeles was different. In its early days, the bank gave mortgages to African Americans who'd been shut out of LA's West Side.
Which, in today's world, is more like along Adams Boulevard, by Adams and Western and those areas.
That's Wayne Bradshaw, Broadway's president and CEO. For decades, the bank kept a tight focus on serving the region's Black community.
Probably for the first 60 years or so, Broadway did a lot of financing with churches and did a lot of their business based on sort of their ethnic commitment. My situation is different.
To understand how it's different, it helps to know a little more about Bradshaw's background. So let's back way up. He's originally from Kingston, Jamaica. He grew up with a single mom who brought him to L.A. in his teens.
Really long story, but she had a very complex and difficult life. And so basically, instead of running away and trying to find a good place, she sort of ended up here. And then I joined her here.
Nobody in his family worked in banking or finance, but Bradshaw was always drawn to it.
Yeah, I loved economics from high school. I absolutely was shocked when I found out people thought it was boring. I had no idea. Because to me, there sort of isn't anything but economics. You have to buy everything. Everything has an economic weight to it.
After high school, he took classes at L.A. City College, then attended the University of Arizona, and eventually got an MBA from USC. As Bradshaw moved into his professional career in banking, he became known as a kind of fix-it guy. Starting in the late 80s, Bradshaw headed two other banks that were on the verge of failure and, one after another, managed to save them.
It's an unintended specialty.
But when he joined Broadway Federal Bank in 2009, it wasn't to turn it around. The bank was in good shape. That changed as the recession dragged on. The bank started to struggle, and the main issue was those church loans that had been so central to the bank's early mission. Many were delinquent.
Broadway's problems were in its church loans. Well, that's a very delicate subject. How do you say that church loans were a problem? Well, because they were, you know. But there's this sort of myth that in the Black community and churches, it's an idyllic situation. Well, it's not.
The problem of Broadway Federal Bank's church loans could be its own story. It's long and complicated and ended up with one of the bank's own employees going to prison for approving bad loans in exchange for bribes. It almost put Broadway out of business.
And so I had to get rid of maybe $100 million in church loans, fix those situations, and then find a way to come up with a product where we could make some money and become a viable institution. And so that's what we did.
To become a viable institution again, Broadway ended up honing in on a new specialty, lending money to small investors in the business of buying what's known as Class C apartment buildings. That means not slum buildings, but definitely not luxury buildings. They're often the older, low-rise properties you see all over L.A. Broadway's sweet spot is financing buildings with 5 to 25 units that cost about $500,000 to $2.5 million.
Why would somebody seek a loan from you instead of Wells Fargo or Bank of America?
That's probably your question of the day. When you're a small bank, you kind of have to look around and you have to figure out, okay, anything that Wells Fargo, B of A, JP Morgan Chase want to do, they can do. So you have to pick something that the big bank doesn't want to do. Because if the big bank wants to do it, you're wasting your time. So why do they not want to do 5 to 25 unit buildings, half a million to 2.5 million? Because they work in increments of billions of dollars. The loans that we do, the reason someone comes to us is because Wells Fargo would not be interested in a loan for $600,000 or $1.2 million. It's too small.
The people receiving the loans are considered small players within the world of real estate investment, but are definitely well off.
Our buildings are owned by very wealthy people. So our average borrower probably has a net worth of $7 million.
Yet, by doing these deals, Bradshaw says, the bank is still serving low to moderate income people, because that's who lives in these buildings. To be clear, Broadway is not an affordable housing financer. These aren't subsidized buildings designated specifically for low-income people, but they're buildings that tend to naturally fall to the low end of market rate. The bank also doesn't finance flips or speculative deals. They work with the landlords or would-be landlords of fully leased buildings based on existing rental income. In doing so, Bradshaw says, the bank has a role in filling a huge housing need.
You don't have to have a graduate degree to realize that if you make $60,000, you cannot afford to buy a house in Los Angeles, which means that almost nobody who is a regular person can afford a house in Los Angeles. So therefore, if somebody has to live someplace other than in their car, there's a tremendous need out there. And that's the need that we try to address. It's the need of where would those people live? And they would live in a decent apartment building that's affordable.
So Broadway Federal Bank is still, in a way, focused on underserved communities. But its business model today, Bradshaw says, is based purely on a financial strategy, not race. And this is where Bradshaw says talking about what the bank does and how it has changed can be difficult. He doesn't want Broadway to be pigeonholed as a black bank, but also doesn't want to seem as if he's rejecting or somehow distancing the bank from its own history.
So that's what we do. We're very proud of it. But it doesn't fit into the image of, so what are you doing for the community, or what are you doing socially, or what you're doing for your blackness? It's like, we do that at church.
While Bradshaw explains Broadway's business model in terms of bottom line dollars and cents, he also feels an emotional connection to what he does. Driving around Los Angeles, he sees the impacts in ways that he wouldn't at a larger bank. For example, he talks about a construction loan the bank recently provided for a new dollar store in Compton.
A dollar store in Compton is meaningful to us because it's a proactive, positive change. So, no, we're very conscious of doing well by doing good.
Yet, Bradshaw is unsentimental about the bank's future. He says eventually, hopefully, Broadway Federal Bank might be taken over by a larger entity.
And that's always one of our goals, to find somebody who thinks they can do a better job, pay us, they take over and we go away. That's sort of your goal. I mean, you're always working towards that end. Yeah, all small businesses are working towards that end. Sometimes they don't know that they're working towards that end, but yeah.
The idea, Bradshaw says, is to keep building something of value. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
Well, speaking of money and building community, I want to take just a quick second to remind you that we're smack dab in the middle of KCRW's UnDrive Pledge Drive. The UnDrive is how we're able to give you all of the KCRW love while continuing to give you all the KCRW you love. We're not spending a ton of time interrupting shows. We're just giving you a reminder that the UnDrive is here. Go to kcrw.com/join for more information on all of the things you can do to upgrade your membership. Coming up, Westminster has a city council drama that's unfolding like a reality show. Up next, Gustavo Arellano helps us figure out exactly what's going on, why their whole council is up for recall. That's next on KCRW's Greater LA. This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Jared Hill. Westminster City Hall could have its own reality TV show. Between the city's infighting, allegations of trickery and coercion, and the recall of all five city council members, There's more than enough intrigue and all-around drama for a TV series. Maybe the real council members of Westminster? Here to spill the tea, maybe dish a little bit, is Gustavo Arellano from this week's OC Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Jarrett.
I bet you weren't expecting to spill the tea today, were you?
Oh, spillage is always great.
Okay, so the Westminster City Council set a record by having the nation's, you know, first Vietnamese-American majority on their city council. 4 out of 5 of their members are Vietnamese-American, and now all 5 seats on the city council are up for a recall. Is this just a power play? Like, what is happening?
Oh, man, we're talking about reality TV. What it really is Game of Thrones. So this is factions going back decades. So, for people who don't know Orange County, when we talk about Westminster, that's the heart of Little Saigon, the biggest population of Vietnamese in the world outside of Vietnam. Like, it's mostly Garden Grove, Santa Ana, but specifically Westminster. So Westminster also had the nation's first Vietnamese-American councilman in Tony Lam back in the 90s. Van Thai Tran was a big, one of the big politicians during the 2000s. And so what you're seeing now is sort of 2 factions in Little Saigon on the city council fighting each other, and then sort of their political godfathers funding money to recall both the majority and also the minority. So the majority of the council, these are the people who are facing the bigger recall. It's council people Kimberly Ho and Charlie Nguyen and Mayor Tri Tha. So they've been around, Tri Tha's been there the longest. I think he's now in his second term. And, when you're in Little Saigon, in Westminster, a lot of the people who are voting there are Vietnamese Americans, and you're getting a lot of political patronage. So the people who have been supporting them specifically is Van Tran. So he used to be a city council member in Garden Grove, actually, and then he ended up becoming a state senator, and then he actually ran for Congress. So he's been long gone from politics, but still has a lot of sway in Republican politics in Orange County. So these are the people that he supported. These are the people that now he's speaking out for as this recall starts going into high gear.
So to continue our Westeros Game of Thrones analogies here, there's 3 different groups behind all of these recalls. Explain who these different groups would be.
So the big one is called Westminster United. So this is the one that that's being backed by a billionaire, a Vietnamese-American billionaire, and they're trying to recall Kimberly Ho, Charlie Nguyen, and Tri Tha. And the person who's really pushing this is one of their rivals on the city council, council member Tai Do. Now, he's the most recently elected council member, and he's also spent all of this year alleging all sorts of financial corruption, all sorts of malfeasance, to the point where Kimberly Ho has actually said, hey, you keep saying these things, I'm probably going to file a defamation lawsuit against you.
Wow.
On the other hand, what you have going against Tai Do and Sergio Contreras, you have another group. Those groups are being pushed by the Republican Party of Orange County. Everyone except Sergio Contreras is a Republican on the city council. And so what they're saying is, hey, we have a Republican majority in Orange County at a time when the Republican Party is dying even in deep red OC. So we got to support these people as much as possible.
So where's all this playing out? Is it like in City Hall? Is it on public access television? Like, where are we seeing all this happening?
Well, it's Little Saigon, so this is still an immigrant, refugee community, so a lot of it's actually playing out on radio. And, especially in Southern California, radio's so gone, everyone, except, of course, for KCRW, everyone's listening to Pandora and Spotify. But in Little Saigon, you still have a lot of lively radio stations where these politicians go on the air and talk all sorts of trash against each other. I mean, you think C-SPAN and Fox News is bad, you should listen to Little Saigon Radio.
Interesting. Okay, so is all of this a distraction from real issues like at stake in Westminster, like, the need for affordable housing and making the city safer and all that?
In the past couple of years, the city of Westminster has had some problems. There's been lawsuits against the police department, not just for police brutality, but also for alleging corruption. You had the former chief of Westminster. A couple of years ago, he wrote a letter alleging, this is the former police chief, alleging that there was corruption inside City Hall. So there are some issues at hand. Of course, this is Westminster. It's a working class town. There's a lot of housing, affordability issues. And also what you're also seeing now, this is sort of the last gasp of the first generation of Vietnamese American politicians. So you have a second generation, which is also clamoring for political representation, more American, for lack of a better term, but definitely a little bit more liberal. And they're trying to say, hey, this city council does not represent us at all. We want to get our foot into City Hall as well.
Interesting. Okay. So with all that going on, it's pretty unlikely that all 5 of those seats are actually going to be recalled, right? What's likely to happen?
You're going to see a lot of money being spent in the next 100 days. This is an issue that's not going to go away. I think that there is, especially the three council members, the majority, they are going to face a recall because one of the people doing it is Dave Gilliard, who's this very famous person in Orange County politics. He actually helped do the recall of Gray Davis, Governor Gray Davis, back in the day. So you're going to see this happen. But whether they actually get recalled, I think that's a whole other issue. And we'll probably talk about it in 100 days.
Gustavo, maybe you can be the Andy Cohen and we can have a Game of Thrones reunion here in about 100 days. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times and is a weekly contributor here on Greater LA. Thanks so much, Gustavo.
Gracias.
I want to remind you that it is National Suicide Prevention Week. So tomorrow we're talking to David Lazarus about his new column in the LA Times talking about weaning himself off of depressions. And as a person living with depression myself, I want to hear from you to be a part of the show tomorrow. Let us know what your experience has been with antidepressants. Tweet at us using the Greater LA hashtag. We're playing Lizzo right now. Hopefully you're feeling good as hell. Have a great day.